We wanted more. We knocked the butt ends of our forks against the table, tapped our spoons against our empty bowls. We were hungry. We wanted more volume, more riots. We turned up the knob on the TV until our ears ached with the shouts of angry men. We wanted more music on the radio. We wanted beats. We wanted rock. We wanted muscles on our skinny arms. We had bird bones, hollow and light, and we wanted more density, more weight. We were six snatching hands, six stomping feet. We were brothers, boys, three little kings locked in a feud for more. Hello, everyone. Kyle Tierman here, and welcome to the show. That was an opening passage from the book We the Animals by Justin Torres. This is a short book, and it is our October book for our little book club here. This book was recommended by my lovely girlfriend. She said that it's one of her favorite books and recommended that we all read it together. So if you want to join our book club, just get We the Animals by Justin Torres at your local bookshop. Should be a quick read, should take you a couple sessions to get through. And you can join our club at tierman.substack.com. I will send you three emails during the month of October to check in, offer quotes, questions, to allow you to reflect on the book a little more deeply. And yeah, it's just a simple, fun thing that we're doing, and would love to hear all of your insights from the book as well. This is a very selfish endeavor. If you haven't caught on to my little racket here yet, I just do shit that I want to do and put it out, talk to people I want to talk to, and reading more books is a personal goal of mine. So I figured that I'd turn it into a little club so that y'all could keep me honest. So We the Animals, get it. Go to tierman.substack.com, type in your email, and I will help keep you accountable. That's it. Tierman.substack.com is also where you can check out all these podcasts and comment on them there. This one is with my good buddy Charlie Hart. Charlie was on this podcast maybe half a dozen episodes ago and got a good response from all of you. So we figured we'd have him back. Charlie is the former head of brand of RX Bar. He's a marketing genius, I tell ya. And now he works with the former pro skater and MTV personality Rob Dyrdek, running a lot of his media assets. He's a thinker, he's a searcher, and I always love chatting with him. We talked a lot about the creative process in this episode. It was wide-ranging. It was rambling. You're going to love it. Please welcome to the show, Charlie Hart.
Kyle Tierman here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
Not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up.
Terrifying.
Terrifying.
That's a good pharmaceutical brand. We didn't know that word, here at Terrifying.
Here at Terrifying, we'll scare the death away from you.
We make pharmaceutical products that keep you scared to death.
Terrifying. Terrifying sounds like terrifying, right?
Well, terrifying is kind of, right?
Is that just farming on Earth?
I think, but I hear people say that.
Terrafarming?
Terrafarming.
Well, Terra is Earth, right?
No, that's my ex-wife. I'm just kidding. Come on. No, terrafarming. Well, how fun is it to just add redundant words to things to make them seem cooler?
Terra?
Like Terra. Like, well, he was a Terra human.
Yeah.
Do you... Oh, you don't get that, do you?
No,
I'm going to have to explain it to you.
I'm Terra breathing right now. I'm starting Terra breathing, Terra breath.
Do tell.
Here at Terra breath, we teach a breathwork technique that you don't even notice. It's the same as regular breathing, but there's a name and a there's Terra and hyphen before breath.
Right.
And as a result, we offer an overpriced subscription that you can pay for, and we make it difficult to cancel.
Right. But because are you truly grounded if you're not firmly planted on the ground?
Here's the thing. If you're not paying a subscription for your breath, are you really valuing it?
Are you putting the necessary attention to the thing that you want to change? Mm-hmm. And is there any greater force of change than capitalism?
Fair enough. But you're paying for your breath these days. I hear you're going up into Topanga, and you're starting. LA's sucking you in, man.
It is.
The west side of all that. We're going to breathe together and share germs, and you're going to feel a sound bath as a result. How is it going?
Well, I would say the breath work is fine. I think where I'm getting the most value is my weekly getting stepped on.
I've heard that you're getting stepped on.
Yeah, I'm getting stepped on.
Yeah, that was
a
great sentence you said yesterday. Yeah, you're like, yeah. Well, the guy who steps on me told me that...
He's a very wise man. Gerasimos knows the nature of the world, and he does step on me
sometimes. I just feel like I'm getting stepped on by the world.
And maybe Tara-stepping.
Tara-stepping.
Tara-stepping. Breath work, I wonder often if I'm doing it right, because people comment on it quite often.
On your breath work.
After the session, they're like, man, it seems like you really needed to release something. I'm like, why? You're not saying that to anyone else here.
Right.
Did I do something?
Isn't that what we're here to do?
That's the whole point.
To release stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know.
So what are they? So are you like screaming between breathing or something?
Well, yeah, but that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to
high-pitched
exhaust
screaming.
And exhale. I do a low to high, okay. You know, like a give it range.
That makes sense.
To vocal range.
It's important.
It is important to show the different sides of you, I think, in breath work.
You know, my big sister is she's a vocal coach.
Oh, you don't say.
Yeah. And she grew up, she was part of an a cappella trio. So like all throughout my childhood in Santa Cruz, I would go to the Kumbwa Jazz Center, and she and two other girls would do it. Over the mountain top, you know, that
beautiful.
Kind of shit. I know. I got
that.
Some pipes.
That, I mean, trained by the best, apparently.
She's quite a bit older than me. Mm. So growing up, we were like, we've always had a good relationship, but she was just kind of out of the house by the time my adult brain came online. Right. So we did a couple vocal lessons together. And one technique that she taught me was you go from low to high, but you think about your shoulders, because often what happens when people go low to high is they'll bring their shoulders up with their voice. So if you can keep your shoulders down and relaxed as you are moving through your vocal range, that's how you keep your throat relaxed.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And there's no greater asset than a relaxed throat. why does that sound?
But shh.
Oh, hello.
Just voice lessons. Like one thing that I was really surprised by is how tired I would be afterwards.
Yeah.
Like it's a very physical. It's a very physical practice. Like you don't realize how much of breath control is going into singing.
Truly.
And how much you're utilizing different muscles when you're going through these different vocal ranges. And also just like how, like was one thing that I did during that I noticed during the class was just that I was hitting notes that I'd never actually hit before. Mm. Like I'm not a good singer, but I was going... It's embarrassing to do a high note as a guy, to go as high as you can, right? Because you're like, oh, I don't feel permission ever to just make my voice as high pitched as it can go and then go as low pitched as you can go. So it's like a very freeing kind of sandbox to just explore
voice. Yeah. You're nodding in a way where I know you're going to be like, I think I should take a lesson.
I think I need a lesson. No, I it's interesting. I'm just thinking of the paradox of we as men don't like to showcase that range. But then we also, I think men, women, anyone in between also appreciates that kind of falsetto voice. Like they're, what is it called? Like the God, help me out here. I forget the name of it.
I think you said the falsetto. That was a good word.
The God tune or something like that. There's like the, and you see children often sing this. And it's like
the Justin Timberlake note.
You know, it's like the certain note that's like the frequency of the harmony of the, I've been in LA too long. Fuck. Okay. there is a note that sounds very pleasing to our ear, and that, I mean, they chopped balls off to try and get to it.
Oh, you know, this was right.
Like the eunuchs, right, of old, to preserve that falsetto sound and that vocal range.
Wow.
So we obviously like it. We like that sound.
That's remarkable. Yeah. My mom came of age in the 1960s, and one thing she said was that she was like going to Bob Dylan concerts when he first started playing the electric guitar, and you know he was the thing, and apparently there were like protests when Dylan stopped smoking cigarettes because people were afraid he was going to lose the rasp in his voice.
Oh yeah. God, and it was already bad to begin with. So, and it's his brand, right? Yeah. So he can't lose the brand of his voice. Yeah,
I've been listening to a lot of Bob Dylan lately. Really? Are you a Dylan fan?
Oh, I love Dylan.
He's crazy.
You know what's interesting? What I'm excited for is in the next 40 years when those songs are re-recorded by people who do have fantastic voices, because he's such a lyricist, as you know, which is why I imagine you like him. But there's some beautiful renditions of his songs out there, and that's only just going to get more and more pervasive. I think Madeleine Poirot is one of the artists. She's this French singer, and oh my God, her renditions of some of his songs are phenomenal.
Are you saying in the next 40 years when his stuff becomes public domain?
Not public domain necessarily, but that's part of it. I think it's just his estate, you know, he's still with us, and I think his estate will probably release the rights to more of his songs and make it more readily available for artists to track, would be my guess. But right.
He wrote Along the Watchtower.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah.
A lot of people think that was a Jimi Hendrix song.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's also like Willie Nelson. It wrote a lot of Patsy Cline songs, some of the most famous ones, actually. I think he wrote the I Go Out Walking After Midnight. I think he wrote that song. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so you're liking the breath work. You've been multiple times.
Yeah.
You've been back to this man who's walking on your back.
Yeah. I do, honestly, you know, there's a reason why some of these things are so popular, but I subscribe to, you know, some of the woo-woo, and ultimately it feels good. It's a good, cathartic release, but it's like anything in life. It's great. All he's doing is applying a great amount of tension and pressure and then releasing it while you're also controlling your breath and doing the same thing, you know, building up tension and pressure and then releasing it, which is what, you know, a very rigid way of looking at breath is. So I enjoy it. Yeah.
I've ever told this story on the podcast. I was down in Costa Rica like 6 years ago, something like that. It was my first time ever trying ayahuasca, which I've done maybe half a dozen times. Haven't done it in a few years. Don't feel like I need to. It's not a fun. I wouldn't say ayahuasca is fun. I wouldn't use that. But it can be very powerful. And I went down to this retreat center in Costa Rica that did ayahuasca ceremonies, and they also did breath work. And there was a breath work class, which I had never done. I'd never done breath work before. I'd never done ayahuasca. And they were doing, it was like one of those 90-minute long breathwork things where you like, you really go and you get the tetany in the hands and like they blast off. Had no idea what to expect. It was a very nice instructor named Nicole who was teaching the class. And it was me and like five other women. Mm. And before the session started, Nicole said, okay, well, breathwork can take you into some, it can tap you into some emotions that might feel uncomfortable. I just as you do in psychedelics, encourage you to not avoid those emotions, just continue to move into them. She said, okay, and before we start, are there any questions or concerns or thoughts that anyone's having? And this girl, very kind of hippie girl in the class, was like, I need to say I feel a little uncomfortable, like possibly releasing into my full emotional expression with a guy here. Like, and just, she could kind of see, like, I looked like a, just like a straight white dude, and like she wanted to go all out. And but she's like, you know, but I think it's fine. I'm not, I just wanted to voice that, but you know, he doesn't need to leave. It's okay. I'm like, okay, yeah, right on. You know, don't expect much to happen. Start doing breath work. About 40 minutes into the class, I start screaming and bawling uncontrollably. Like, blasted into another universe. Mm. Like, don't know my body's here anymore. Get taken back to this moment of, like, breaking my arm really badly and like having this like trauma shake out of my body, and like I'm like in a ball and the instructor has to come over to me and like turn me on my side, and like afterwards we all like sit in a circle and share, and the girl's like, well, I didn't expect that to happen. Yeah, I went to Costa Rica for the drugs and came back with the breath work.
Yeah, you brought a drug back home with you.
Yeah.
One but, you can come back to. I find breath work to be, I mean, totally revealing and hallucinogenic. Like, and, you know, there's science to back this up too, but, you know, getting high on your own supply, as it were. And I've had crazy experiences doing very similar things, and usually it's like the 90-minute sessions, and I went to one actually here that had music accompanying it, and you know, the same thing, you get the seizure in your hand, your feet, and then your stomach sort of gets warm and numb, which is a very strange feeling, but then you get kind of lifted into this other dimension, and I think part of, like, if you just look at it from a pure optimization standpoint,
which we always do.
I mean,
why is life worth living if not to optimize?
Always be optimizing. The Kyle Tierman podcast. The part of it is teaching yourself, at least for me, I'll focus it on me, as I always do. It's teaching yourself how to ride to the edge and be comfortable with anxiety, because, and this is what a lot of drugs do, but I think breath work creates a safe environment for you to experience the feeling of a micro death in a lot of ways, and come out the other side whole and fine, and safe, and with some kind of, not always, but usually some kind of revelation. And I think part of the, you know, the poo-pooing of the woo, the poo-poo of the woo-woo is the fear of vulnerability, and we're living in an era where irony is king, as you know, and we don't want to be caught unawares or feel stupid. And so woo-woo is this, you know, attack on really a practice that a lot of people are doing around self-discovery. And I grant you, there's a lot of pseudo, you know, spiritual people out there that, you know, think that one breath work is going to change their life, and they go home and they're an asshole still and nothing's changed.
Yeah. But I'm a coach, by the way, now.
Yeah, I'm a coach.
You can go to my website.
Yeah, you can go to my website. It's a subscription. $5,000 an hour. I figured it out, guys. I'm a, the answer to life. But in a lot of ways, it's just it's a process for self-discovery. And I think we live in a lot of rigidity, and we're very anti-vulnerability right now. And I think there's, you know, what's fun about breathwork is that you're not sharing vulnerability, you're internalizing vulnerability. So it's all very self-serving instead of like burdening other people with your trauma.
What do you mean by we live in an age of irony?
What I mean by that is I think we... You see it in cinema, you see it in any sort of entertainment vehicle, that a lot of subject matter is dripping in irony. You see it in the way that people talk online, the way that we do social media. There's this sort of air of...
Snark.
Snark, almost to the point of nihilism. Like, yeah. It fucking doesn't matter. Yeah. And it rides the line between, I think, nihilism and pessimism. And pessimism is basically, you know, nihilism with an agenda. Like, you know, fuck, nothing matters, so I'm going to fuck it all up, you know, kind of thing. There's an action-oriented nature to it.
Right.
And I think we're living in a culture that is snarky out of defense because it's scared. All of society feels very scary and overwhelming. And so if I don't take it too seriously, if I take it ironically, then I'm protected in some way. And so, you know, brands are doing this, people are doing this, movies are doing this. There's always like some clever twist or what you thought it was isn't actually what it was. And there's some reveal that's supposed to feel, you know, like a gotcha at the end. And I think, you know, we talked a little bit about this last time. Earnestness is usually a sign of prosperity in culture when people are forthright, vulnerable, and pragmatic and practical and generally open. And movies reflect that. I mean, 80s was a very strong period for earnestness. You know, we talked about Top Gun last time. Top Gun's a very earnest movie. And even Barbie, to an extent, there's, you know, some irony in that movie, but it's a pretty earnest, you know, it's clever, but it's pretty earnest all the way through. And on the nose, I mean, it's very much... you know,
two on the nose, some might say, after walking out of the movie theater.
Potentially, as you did.
Call me sexist, but I didn't like it.
I didn't understand the movie. What are all these chicks doing on the screen? Get over it. No,
I didn't really like it, but I feel it was funny to me walking out of the theater being like, am I allowed to not like this?
Yeah.
Oh God.
Which is a whole other issue.
Right, but I very much agree with you that snark is in vogue, and it's and doing it incessantly is a kind of armor, and it I think keeps I think we see this, like I see this with comedy specials where comedy is like, okay, we're going to build up a premise but tear it down. But I think that the really great comedy specials have an element of real vulnerability in them. Like, they're, you know, it's snarky, you're making fun of it, but when the comic can thread, I'll just use the example of, like, I really loved Neil Brennan's special Blocks, where he made this really vulnerable choice at the very end of it. So Blocks is like, here are my mental blocks, and that's the premise of his special is kind of feeling alone in the world, and it's hilarious all throughout it. But in his final act, he tells this story with no punchline at the end, and it's fucking moving because he doesn't tear down the premise at the very end, and it's like, whoa. I think one of his last lines is like, if it's just one thing, like I can handle it, but then all these blocks just become overwhelming, and like I just hope that my thoughts, my actions, my habits, like I just hope they're enough. I just need to give myself some grace, let that be enough. And it's like, woof! Like you expect to, but he just makes you sit in that real feeling with him, and it's fucking so profound. Like, I don't really write comments to people I don't know online, and I like wrote a comment on one of his Instagrams and was like, bro, I just want you to know that was really powerful.
And I have some of your hair.
Yeah.
I have a lock of your hair. Yeah,
I want you to know I've been going to the vegan restaurant that you frequent for 9 years.
I know what you order.
And this is a doll that I've made out of you.
All right.
But yeah, it's I feel that in my own writing, like the people who I share my writing with, you being one of them, I think often try to push me into a state where it is revealing and scary. Mm. And that, like, that feeling of creating something that is scary to share is often where you need to be. And it's really easy to rely on snark to keep yourself safe.
Yeah. It's the most touching side of things, I think. Like there's a predominant theory in creation, you know, creating works of art, that if you remove the catharsis at the end, it forces your audience to think. Mm. Because we're all looking for that cathartic ending, to laugh, to cry, to, you know, long, to be hopeful, whatever it is. And most movies, most books, most work of art follow that formula, because audience are pissed when you don't land the plane and give them some sort of cathartic ending. But when you don't, you sort of sit in what I think part of the reasoning is when you don't give a cathartic ending, there's no mental conclusion in your head. There's no bookend anymore. And so you're left with that thought rotating in your head. And the theory goes that you're forced to sort of contemplate it and solve it on your own. Because you can hide a lot of things. You can hide a lot of really bad ideas in catharsis.
Huh. Yeah. Because you just spoon feed the meaning at the end.
Right. What's the phrase? It's, you know, things, something about going down with sugar. I'm going to butcher it. But, you know, you can create terrible ideas, but as long as it sounds good and has a cathartic ending to it, people will buy most anything that you say, right? And we have this cadence of speech now and storytelling that's da 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 da. And people are like, oh God, that feels good. And we seek this out right now. I think in culture, we seek out validation and answers and simple stories, and that, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. Simplicity in storytelling is a biological need. Like we can't store that much information. So we look for really cathartic, simple, you know, ABC stories to be able to make sense of the world. But the question is, does that rob us of truly intellectualizing or interpreting the world around us? Or are we just, you know, spoon feeding ourselves stories that are convenient and feel good?
Right.
And I think we live in a culture right now, I've said that like 800 times.
Yeah, just stop.
I'm going to stop. I think we live
you
in a culture.
You can say the same thing without that preamble.
People understand.
It makes your next idea sound big.
It does.
We live in a culture where I'm going to get some cereal.
We live in a culture where cereal is going down my gullet.
We live in a culture where Kyle flushed the toilet.
Yeah, sorry. Kyle, flush the toilet. We live in a culture. I think people are, I've lost the thought.
Well, I'll continue the thought with Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey, mm-hmm. which I was just having a conversation about. And the point in the conversation was that often, so the hero's journey is, there's the hero in regular life. The hero is called by some supernatural force. Often the hero at first refuses the call to adventure. They then agree to the call of adventure. Next, they find some sort of mentor who helps them along the journey. There may be one or two mentors. There is then the ultimate challenge, where there's this there's a number of different ways that people talk about it, but it's like the death, the rebirth, the pinnacle. There's then the knowledge and wisdom gained from the death, or the ultimate challenge, and then there's the bringing back of that ultimate challenge to their home, and or to themselves in some way, right? They finish where they began. And what this guy who was talking about the hero's journey was saying is that often stories will end right after the death, rebirth, and they won't have a final chapter of the coming home. So the example was like Rocky films end when Rocky wins or loses the fight. But he says that a lot of epics have their epic air to them when there is this chapter of reflection. He used Lord of the Rings as that example. So Lord of the Rings could have ended when Frodo tossed the ring into Mordor, but there's a whole final section where he returns to the Shire and imparts the wisdom learned home.
Mm. And in doing that, we get to see that life is not the same.
Right.
Right. We get to see how they agonize over the complexity and intensity of the journey that they've gone on. And that is not a simple story. I mean, Lord of the Rings does end with Frodo being like, fuck, I have seen some shit and I can't live on this planet anymore. And I have to go to a different realm. That's intense. That's not a happy ending. That, I mean, by a lot of respects, that's not like, you know, gets the accomplishment, the success, the marriage, and, you know, we're a happy family. It's actually a very honest outcome.
But you like fucked up stories, which is why I can't watch movies with you at night.
Yeah.
You're always like at like 8:30 p.m. You're like, hey, let's watch a movie. And I'm like, if it was Hitch, a great film.
Is it?
Hitch is a master. Hitch is a goddamn masterpiece,
it's a
Charlie.
Masterpiece. Oh, Will Smith and whatever that other guy's name is.
I don't know, but it's beautiful. Mall Cop guy. Those are feel good movies. You like movies that end in a fucked up situation and then force you to grapple with it for the next 2 days, and I will grapple with it for the next 2 days, including the night, so I can't watch your fucking No Country for Old Men that you always try and tow me into.
Oh, man. I just watched that actually like 2 days ago for like the 400th time.
The scene where he's like, can you just hold still there?
Can you just hold still?
Oh.
Call it. God. And there's more than one reason why I love that film. It's, as you know, it's a Cormac McCarthy.
Your fave.
Based off the book, my favorite author, fanboy for McCarthy. And McCarthy often ends his books with the antithesis of catharsis. There is no buttoning of the tying of the bow, as it were. And No Country for Old Men ends on a dream, as a lot of his books do. And it's ambiguous and strange, as all McCarthy books are. But it forces you to, you don't get that like, ah, and the journey was done. It forces you to contemplate and think. And you know, Hitch is a fine movie, but it's empty calories. You're not doing any work to sort of interpret or mirror what the world is really like. And it doesn't, I think you can watch a movie, and when a movie does this effectively, you're not internalizing or thinking, and you're forced to live in the perspective of whoever the artist is for that short period of time. And you come out with a new reference point, a new way of seeing the world at its best, but not always.
Do you feel, I know that one thing that we've kind of always, like ideas we've tossed around are, so books are the original, I guess oral storytelling is the original form of storytelling, hunter gatherers and early cavemen telling stories around the fire. Then it was written, the written word told stories through the written word. Then there were films. And this might be two
things in between there.
There were some things in between, I guess.
That's really good.
And then there were, and then there was,
and then podcasts.
And then podcasts, and it was all over. Working as a marketer, and working with brands, which brands do you think are telling the most powerful stories within culture right now? Because brands, like, I think that we're in an interesting moment in culture right now, Charlie.
Okay.
Yeah.
Engaged.
Are you, you just lean forward.
I'm engaged.
I'm going to do the politician thing with my pen, with my hand. Like I'm signing a document right now with this statement, where you have brands like Nike coming out with Air, which is a feature length film with Ben Affleck and Matt Damon. You have brands kind of making their way into culture through various storytelling vehicles, like and telling these, like, I thought Air was a great film. Telling these stories that I suppose have like a wider range of canvases with which they can kind of like tell their story. So that was a long wind up to say, which brands do you think are telling the most interesting stories in culture? And do you think that there is ever a way for brands to tell stories that could be as deep and complex and interesting as a Cormac McCarthy book?
I don't know if there's a simple answer to that question. I don't know if they have the right to do that or if anyone cares enough for them to do that. I think when brands start to evolve into a space where they're trying to tell wider stories, I think that can be interesting. But the problem is when they want you to care, we talk about this through the form of a newsletter. It's like, there's a reason why a lot of newsletters from brands fail. It's like, I buy your product and I think about it for 0.02 seconds of my life. I don't need to read a fucking newsletter from you that you know, gives me 0.4% more value in my day. Like, no matter how good it is, the framing of that is, in my opinion, kind of arrogant. Like, I think there's ways of getting around it. But as you know, a lot of these newsletters end up just being a feeder for, I mean, probably now with ChatGPT, but just a feeder of empty content that is meant to entice you to
buy something. Yeah. Yeah. So, I guess that the ultimate, Frodo Baggins coming back to the Shire from a brand marketing standpoint is always buy now. So it does limit the, potentially the narrative arcs that you can take people on.
Right. And that's not an invisible conversation. That's not a quiet conversation. I mean, that is the notation in the whole thing. I mean, this is what gets so ridiculous is when people talk about brands as cults, it's like, is it though? Like, or is it just a momentary transaction that someone is making to reflect something about themselves or to, you know, improve some aspect of their life, but to consider that it's a cult in some way feels like it misses the point. And the point is that you, and maybe I mentioned this last time, but you don't be the cult, be the Kool-Aid, right? Be the thing that is a status symbol for your cult, for your community, that signals to other people in it that you're aware of the tenets, you're aware of the philosophy of that cult. And a perfect example of that is, you know, tech bros wearing Patagonia, people that buy Cards Against Humanity and display it on their shelf, right? Like, you're saying something about the community that you want to be a part of by embracing that item. But is Patagonia in its own right a cult? I would argue no. It is. It's a uniform for a lot of subcults, that all across the world, and it understands that role and it tries to toe the line. Nike is very much the same way. Nike is successful in so many ways, but I think in particular in that they understand their role sufficiently, that they are not the cult. Nike is not the cult. They are facilitating the Kool-Aid for all these individual cults, from streetwear to basketball to athletic, you know, whatever the athletics are. I played a lot of sports.
So how would you, like, if you're growing a brand, what would the mistake be to try and be the cult? Like, when really you is it just to go too wide with your messaging? Or, like, in, because for sure Nike has a newsletter and Nike's, you know, they have a lot of media, but like, what is the mistake that you see brands make when they try and be the cult when they should be the Kool-Aid?
I think there's a few things in it. One is they don't listen. So they don't understand what the community, where their position is within the community. So, I mean, I can draw an example from my own experience. RX Bar early on, you know, we weren't trying to create a cult around RX Bar. It's a fucking protein bar. Like, no one's going to form a cult around a protein bar. And if they do, good luck. maybe they should die. The realization for us was that CrossFit was actively using this product, and people in the community use it as sort of a status symbol to kind of showcase their involvement in that very cult-like sport. The cult was CrossFit. RX Bar was not. RX Bar was facilitating and building prestige for the people that wanted to signal within that cult. So the job of RX Bar is to create a great product, to showcase its premium nature and to create artifacts of the brand that felt resonant and salient. So simple packaging, really funny activations, really fun, interesting advertising, like all those things are further enhancing this view that RX Bar is this trendy, interesting, provocative brand, that's no bullshit, which is, turns out, very CrossFit in nature, very, you know, provocative, no BS, get it in, get the fucking work, whatever, the hit today, that kind of thing. So we were pairing to a lot of the sentiment within CrossFit. And I think when you scale a brand like Nike, it's like, holy shit. I mean, that, think about all of the different subsets that they have to cater to in an integral, honest way. They don't do that unless they listen, and they have a ton of ambassadors on the ground that are part of these communities that are feeding them information about what they're looking for, what they want. Nike's not planting a flag and saying we're the cultural monolith. That they're saying that, you know, we're, or that we're the cult monolith. We're saying that we understand your culture and we want to be a part of it.
That's good. That is good. I like that. Yeah, it's. I heard a really talented copywriter once say, "As soon as you're saying we're here to change the world, you've gone too big."
Way too big, way too big.
But I think that the reason for it is because we want to feel important and we want to feel meaning in our lives. And many people work at one company or another, and they want to, it feels good when you think you are changing the world, right? Like, that's a very ego emboldening idea. So the thought that, hey, you go to work and spend 8 hours a day every day at this office for a transaction that someone will think about for 1.5 seconds of their day doesn't feel good. Mm-mm. It feels way better to be like, we're leading you towards a life of purpose.
Yeah, yeah.
But
we're changing the world.
But then you stop listening, right? Like, which is, I mean, it's like,
it's noise. Yeah.
Yeah. And it takes, I think that when you know, egomania makes you tone deaf. Right. The more self-important you feel you are, the harder it is to listen to the world around you.
Well, that's just it. Yeah. You shut off your hearing.
Yeah.
You stop interpreting. I think part of the issue here too is scale. And this, we've just come out of this era of scale mania. How can we scale this business? How can we scale to $1 billion? How can we be a unicorn? And I think
Terrascale.
Terra Scale. Welcome to Terra Scale.
Scale mania.
Scale mania.
Verbal.
Come on down to Scale Mania. I think it's at a disservice to, and doesn't recognize, I think, the way that the world works. A lot of really great things can only happen in the micro.
Mm.
And often that's where, you know, good brands came from, was a micro idea that solved very niche, very pointed problem, and then tried to figure out how do we scale. And now you're having people ask me this all the time when they're looking for me to invest or they're asking for advice. It's like, yeah, but we're, and I say, like, what do you want to do with this? How, you know, where do you want to go with it? And it's like, well, we want to be a $1 billion company. It's like, what are you, you haven't sold a fucking thing yet. Like, go sell something, yeah, and then figure out if you want to be or can be a $1 billion company. And the point in why it's bad is because when you design, when you create for a $1 billion company, or let's just throw money out the door, when you scale or design for as many people as possible, what happens? You lose out on the specifics, and your thinking becomes very common denominator. So no one's happy. When you design for everybody, you design for nobody. And you lose that specificity. You lose the soul. You lose the problem that you're actually trying to solve, because you're trying to help every single person. And so my advice typically in any kind of creative operation or business is start with a very, very specific problem. Hmm. And then try and build from there.
If you could have lunch with any living marketer, and I'll use that term incredibly broadly, it could be in film, could be in product, who would it be?
Oh, man. I would this is off the cuff, and it may not be the actual answer, but I would love to have lunch with the guy, I believe his name is David Maisel, who is the genesis of the MCU, Marvel Cinematic Universe. Just because his story, which I think is coming to light more prevalently now, he's, I think, on kind of a podcast circuit, but of how he envisioned building something that specific, and was able to orchestrate it by pulling in really difficult partners from Disney to Marvel and Sony and beyond, to create that world and that opportunity, which I know is a little contradictive, because he thought about scale in mind. But they thought what it could be, but they got hyper specific on what it is. And the first thing they built was Iron Man, right? And
Iron Man. Was that before X-Men?
Mm-hmm. Well, he wasn't a part of X-Men. X-Men wasn't a part of the MCU. Get your facts straight, you nerd. Oh, my God.
Okay, so what is it about this guy, David?
I think David Maisel.
David Maisel. What is it about him that you that intrigues you so much?
I think it's how he was able just that to orchestrate across multiple partners. And well, here,
and what? So, give me a background of what he really did.
So, what he did was he joined Marvel at a time when, you know, people barely knew that name, you know, from at a sort of mass entertainment level, and they had done a few licensing deals and were struggling, and no one had any concept of how you build out a universe, so to speak. And now that is what everyone's trying to do, and for good reason, which I'll explain in a second here. But he joined Marvel with this pretense of, hey, I think I can help scale this out, take this existing IP and do something very special with it, and bring around the right partners. And if I'm thinking about the story correctly, they moved from, hey, let's not license this, let's have more, production control over it, and partnered, I believe, with Disney to launch Iron Man, and did a lot of risk taking in it, and ultimately saw the fruits of their labor, and it was a smash hit, banking on a very, you know, tumultuous actor at the time, and Robert Downey Jr., who you know hadn't had a career up in you know for 10 years, but he just the way that he both envisioned what it could be, and literally he tells it like you know overnight he has a dream of some kind, you know that kind of thing, and envisions how he could tie all these things together out of this concept that a sequel is more of a sure bet and more financially, you know, fruitful and profitable in the end, and more predictive. Like they could predict what the sales trajectory of a sequel would be far greater than a new movie. But people are tired of sequels. How do we create something that feels like a continuation of a story without it being just a direct sequel? And so I think that's the innovation, was like, how do we build trust in the brand, in Marvel, instead of trust in a specific actor or a specific storyline? You know, and effectively, that's how the MCU was born.
That's fascinating.
You know, great profits. And the annoyance of the entire artistic world.
Yeah. And that's why we don't have any more No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, they're gone. Well, no comedies. And there's a confounding or compounding factor in that, and streaming and a whole bunch of other things. But yeah.
Wow, that's fascinating. That's really fascinating. Do you, can you think of any questions that you would want to ask?
What's your favorite color?
Yeah.
I think I would probably ask him what the biggest resistance to change was throughout the negotiations with Disney and internally with Marvel, how he navigated something that was clearly a very risky venture. What was the pitch internally and externally on how this was going to work? And so what was that process? And did it ultimately, beyond profit, turn out to be the way that he pitched it and predicted it would be?
That's a great question. Yeah.
Interesting.
One article that you shared with me, which I mean, it's just fascinating because, you know, I spent my 20s, and island hopping in search of great waves, and you spent it building an empire of a business. So you have much more of an understanding of the internal workings of big brands and scaling brands, and how much politics goes into making these moves, and how to navigate these various relationships. And one article that you sent me, I think it was an Atlantic article or New Yorker article, with the new head of CNN.
Oh, Chris Licht.
Chris, yeah. Licht, who came in, and it was a long form piece. Was it a New Yorker article?
I believe it was a New York Times.
New York Times. And it's great. It's just all about the internal mechanics of a new, you know, leader coming in, trying to change culture, and him ultimately sort of failing at the task, and the internal team rejecting him. And I just felt like read that article with X-ray vision, because you're like, yep, I see. Like, and then afterwards we talked about it, and you're like, I think you said something like, it's like you had a great metaphor. It was something like, if the leader comes in, like, it's almost like the internal team are antibodies or something.
Oh yeah. Any kind of new addition to a team is like open heart surgery,
right?
The body will either reject it or accept it. And it's a very fine balance, when that happens, or if it happens. And you have to be very, very careful. I think people, through ego and through fear, and it's all natural, when they come into a new organization, like to put their name on the masthead and quickly prove themselves, right? And so when it's full circle, when you listen to your ego instead of the people around you, you don't actually get the insights that you need to make effective change. And I think that's probably one of the symptoms. And I want to cut this guy a lot of slack. I mean, it's an impossible job that he was ultimately put at the helm of. And he, you know, from my observation, made mistakes, but there's also so much in the details there that we're not seeing, and, right. and things probably felt right at the moment.
Right. So this guy was, I think he was Stephen Colbert, senior producer.
That's right.
And then he got the opportunity to be the head of CNN mm-hmm. when CNN was trying to regain trust as a centrist news organization.
Right. And I mean, say what you will, but is that even possible to do at this point? CNN or any other organization to be centrist, you know, is to people want their news entities, entertainment entities to have a point of view and to feed them that point of view. So, you know, him coming in, would that have made, could anyone have come in and made a difference? And I think one of the crucial elements of that piece is that he had a 5-year plan and only had, a year and a half to execute before they cut him loose, you know, most likely from the article and other contributing factors. But it's like, change takes time. Good things take time. And if you came in under the pretense that you were going to have that time and then were, you know, people are going to chide you for the inevitable rocky ground that's going to happen when you do big change, then, you know, anyone would have faltered in that sense. Mm-hmm. I think in reading it, one of the reflections that I have on just like leadership in general is I think good leaders ask good questions. And that's really what their central role is to jump into an organization and ask the appropriate question at the appropriate time, and then to build framework around it. And you know, one of my favorite maxims in life is an old Ogilvy quote, which is, give me the freedom of a tight brief, right? In specificity, there is freedom, because when you ask me to do everything, then suddenly I can't do anything because it's overwhelming. I don't know where to start. I have nothing to go on.
I thought it was puff, puff, give. That was the maxim that live your life by. But
well, that's my secret that's one. That's the same. But, you know, that's what I do on Fridays. Okay. The point being that we give...
Our comedy sucks in this podcast.
Yeah, this one's bad, we
just, you know, it's a midday podcast, so we keep... I love that we're both bombing. I think
Wait,
overall...
speak for yourself. Yeah. I feel like I'm killing
we're both
it
right now.
I feel like I am nailing it.
I hear the audience cricketing.
I hear
this audience sucks.
I hear quiet anticipation. Yeah. and one of those smiles, like it's half pity but half like, you know, anticipation.
They tried
you know, like,
okay yeah, just
I'm gonna give them the benefit of the doubt.
Get on with the smart stuff.
Yeah,
okay, good, Charlie. Do your big thinky stuff.
So
I think that's a great insight, and another, you know, a detail of that article, right, was that he got an office on his own floor. Like, he very much seemed to be separate from the organization in some very big ways that you pointed out to me, like, ooh, I wouldn't have done that.
Yeah. Which is, it sounds so funny, in its own right. You know,
I'm clearly we're peanut gallering here, but I think that it's...
Yeah, like I want to be respectful of... you know,
I
like,
think it's interesting, Chris, if you're listening. I'm sure it was a really hard job. We can all go have some margarita sometime. It's going to be okay.
Chris.
But I think that... Yeah, well, I just think that it's... Go for it.
No, I'm done.
I think that scaling or just coming into any business in any capacity with any team size has a few principles that you have thought about, and it was a good conversation to have after having read that article to listen to you talk about some things that you noticed and some lessons that you've learned along your own trials and tribulations.
Yeah. Yeah, I think chief among them is just listen. just listen and let people be seen. It's a scary fucking time when a new person comes in. It is, it's open heart surgery, right? And so people are trying to very quickly make an analysis of where they stand and if they're safe and if they're seen. And especially if you command a leadership position of that size and that quality, people are going to try and get you to love them. And if you don't reciprocate any kind of attention or any kind of acknowledgement, they will turn on you. Mm. They will fucking destroy you. And it's so rudimentary because they want to be seen. They want to be loved ultimately and respected. These are very core needs, they're very basic needs. And I think when you come into an organization assuming you know better than the people that have been there for 30 years, you're creating the conditions for chaos and disaster. And I think one of the qualities that I think he did well was, he made decisions quickly, including the town hall with Trump, which a lot of people say was a miss. I have no opinion on it, but I think he was trying to quickly signal to people what the new CNN was going to be. And as a leader, that's also an important quality. You need to make decisions quickly. You have to have a good decision-making framework. Because in any startup, if you have no framework for making decisions, you're not adapting and you die very, 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 very quickly because you can't afford to stall in a startup environment or in a high-intensity environment like CNN.
Hmm.
So I think to that we can applaud him.
Asking good questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, being the iron fist in any capacity, whether it's in a business or surfing or just, over accentuating your knowledge of the thing is usually, the result of some kind of overcompensation of really not knowing. It's like have we talked about Batesian mimicry? It's like this concept where animals that like there are poisonous snakes, sea snakes, and evolution has found a way to have other snakes mimic the color of this poisonous snake, although they don't have the poison. And those snakes are often brighter than the poisonous ones. And, you know, this happens like whether it's in surfing, if you're just getting into the sport, you're going to really overdo it. Like you're going to wear all the surf clothes. You're going to put up all the surf posters. Like when in reality, like the people who are ripping the hardest usually like will roll up in like a construction outfit or something. Right. But, we have that tendency to overdo things when we're learning the craft.
Back to signaling and Colt and Kool-Aid, right? I mean, this is propped up many a business is the need to feel like I belong to the community. And that's the driving force behind a lot of the conversation earlier is I want to feel like I belong. I want the CrossFit community to think I belong. So I buy, you know, Noble shoes and I buy RX bars and I go to the things to signal to the other people in there that I speak the language, that I'm worthy of the cult. Same with tech bros. I put Patagonia on and I wear my stupid boat shoes and I coif my hair. Fucking idiots. So that I can be in the group and signal to people that I belong here. Ultimately, it's about feeling like you belong and seeking out tribe and community. I mean, again, these are basic principles that underline all the things that we do from marketing to business to, you know, dinners to communities to whatever it ultimately is.
Mm.
Hold for applause.
Hold for applause. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Yeah. Well, what are the skills you're trying to get better at right now? Enough about all this
biz talk, this
thin veneer of showmanship.
Mm.
What's the thing that you're like, fuck, if like by next year I could be really good at this thing, what would it be?
I think what it would be is creative output. And that's a very broad statement, but I'll say what I mean is I want to be more proficient as a one unit show to be able to leverage technology, AI or otherwise, to be able to output more of what I am thinking and feeling. And I think a lot of that, like anything in this world, comes down to process and principles. And so what I'm trying to do is learn skills like, you know, animation and video editing and all those things so that I can better articulate the things that, you know, I ultimately want to see in the world.
Mm. Yeah. You want to talk about Naughty Bets? Too late now. Let's talk about what advice you would give. You just walked right into my trap. Do you see that?
Okay, here we are. You framed that well.
Yeah, you like that?
I do. Yeah, you like
that. Now you're in my lair. what is Naughty Bits? And then I want to talk about the creative process within Naughty Bits, because from my perspective, just, you know, having known you over the last year and having, you know, you showed me this creepy website the first day that we met.
Well, no.
And and awesome. Until now, I think that you have had a lot of really important insights as a creator that it's cool to see. And I think that those lessons could be imparted, you know, to others as you're in this process of bringing Naughty Bits out to the world.
Mm. I have a few lessons learned. What is Naughty Bits? So Naughty Bits is a pseudo-sexual universe that's meant to commentate, explore, dissect how media involves us and traps us, and ultimately entertains us, and how we untangle the benefits and pitfalls. And it's just fun.
It's just fun.
Ultimately, it's
your
just
sandbox.
Fun. It's become...
It allows you to really go for your high highs and low lows vocally.
That's right.
That's at the center of this.
It's, and that's why I get stepped on weekly, is to be able to get to those high highs. It's been the most invaluable teacher, honestly, which it sounds so annoying. But it's been a really great lesson in how to create efficiently, effectively, and how to stare at the void and feel like everything is failing and it won't work and you're a terrible human, and then be like, oh wait, actually I have an idea, and then walk back.
Right.
You know, I think that's always part of the creative process, is a healthy dose of despair through the whole thing.
That's great.
But I think what it's turned into for me, you know, without going into the full journey, is like you said, a sandbox for creating this very strange, hyper-specific universe. And I think a few things that I've learned from it is to just be hyper-specific.
Mm.
I'm building it for me, and that means two things. One is I'm building it because it's fun to build and I like building it. And if it entertains me, then ultimately it's entertaining. And I'm not trying to scale it. I'm not trying to make this whole big thing. For me, it's more of an act of expression and more about the process than it is the final product.
Mm.
So that's a big part of it. I think this is the most annoying advice you could give. Are you ready for it?
Yes.
When in doubt, just start.
Mm, that is so annoying.
It's so annoying.
But I will, from an outsider's perspective, underscore that advice, because I think that this whole project has kind of turned into a monster for you, where you know, it's fun. It's a great idea. It's, you know, you have these various storylines that you're executing you know, with your own voice, you know, you're writing these different, like, frickin' Westworld-style storylines with these characters that are incredibly complex, and I think with that can come a kind of burden for it to be great. And I've seen you in moments where you're just like, fuck, this feels too big to even start, and you were under this false premise that, like, okay, well, I'm just going to work for 24 hours straight on it and then not work on it for 2 weeks and then do 24 hours again. And, you know, that doesn't work. And I've seen you shift your strategy to waking up early and just working on it for 1 hour every day. And I've noticed a lot of progress with that strategy shift. And I think that it's, you know, some of the best books you've ever read have been written 1 hour a day. So I think that that's a shift that you should applaud yourself for.
Yeah. The building the routine around it was huge, because if you just assign a day to do it, which is, as you noted, something I would do, I'm like, okay, I'm just going to spend Friday doing this. It becomes way too big and exhaustive, and doing it in micro movements, an hour a day, at the same time every day, after the same routine every day, doesn't allow you to walk away, because it becomes just part of the disciplinary, you know, tactic, habit,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So all you have to do is show up is kind of the idea. And I think that's true of most habits. It's if you can remove all the friction and the pressure from it, that and make it so that the only thing you have to do is show up. For me, at least, that's been true of all things, working out or you know, doing reach outs or, you know, whatever it is, art projects and beyond. So that's been a huge insight. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to doing voices, mm-hmm. what do you do? I'll hear you, like, from your room and be like, is there, like, a girl in there right yeah. now? Like, it feels like is there some kind of, like, bank robbery happening right now with a woman?
Yeah.
How do you get yourself into that state? Because you're writing these various scenes mm-hmm. with sometimes a woman is in the scene, sometimes a man's in the scene. Like, what's the process? Do you write it and then do it into your mic, like speak the lines into your microphone?
Yeah.
Right after that? Or what's that process look like?
Well, I'll give you the micro and then the macro. So the micro is I write it and then I find it. Like, I write it and then I do the voices, and it's a whole production with music and sound effects and all sorts of things. This is all on I won't say where it is yet, but part of it is, you know, I subscribe to this idea that everything is a rhythm, and you can feel that rhythm, you can hear that rhythm, you can see that rhythm. And when things click, you just, you know when it happens, you feel when that happens. Mm. And I'm sure there's some broader rationalization of that and, you know, backing to that. But in my words, you know, that's how I feel. And so when you're in the moment of creation, putting sound together, putting audio together, for me personally, like, I know when it doesn't sound the way I want it to sound or doesn't click, and I know when it does. And so I'm searching for that actively. So that might mean changing the script in real time and improvising a line or adding this thing here where it now has this balanced rhythm to it that ultimately clicks. And I think that in the macro sense is a very, very valuable lesson that things take time. And part of the creative process is faith that you're going to find it. Like, if you show up and you keep working on it, you're going to connect all the little synapses in your brain, all the little data points that you've collected over the, you know, course of your lifetime. And they're going to mix together to give you something that will work for whatever the thing is that you are creating. But you have to start, the engine has to be on and moving and forward, you know, moving forward for you to capture that. If Naughty Bits was what it was when I started, I don't think I would like it or be interested in it. I'm only interested in it because it's evolved through that process, through improv and playing and, you know, evolving it over that time.
What do you think your a weakness of yours is as a creative?
I think I inevitably try and 10x everything. So that advice about scale is as much for other people as it is for myself. I will immediately try and figure out what the larger ecosystem is and production and how to build, you know, into a massive audience and all that. I do that in everything. And it sounds like it would be a skill, which there are elements that are helpful, but ultimately it's a disservice because you build a mountain and then you have to climb it. And so I would say, you know, create the mountain that you're willing to climb if you want to actually get anything done.
Boom. That's good. Create the mountain you're willing to climb.
Write that down.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very good. And I do think that your strength is simultaneously your weakness with everything, right?
Yeah. Well, it's like when Luke walks into the swamp and faces Darth Vader and ultimately slays him, only to find it is himself.
Ooh.
We are our own worst enemy.
Joseph Campbell.
Through the cave, you will find the treasure.
Wow. Bring it all home right there.
It all went full circle. But I do, just to land the plane on that, I think it's... I think we have a tendency to, at least me, I'll speak through the lens of me, I have the tendency to 10x and to create a grand scale for something as a way to avoid it. So that if I build it too big, then I get to happily live in this beautiful, perfect world where the idea is so flawless and so beautiful and so big that I never have to work on it. And a lot of this process and any kind of creative process, any kind of brand building, business building, is how do I make it a mountain that I can actually climb instead of me glorifying and fantasizing the thing that I know I'll never actually get around to.
What's your biggest fear within all of this?
I think it simultaneously is time wasted. So it's time in, which I'm very grateful for, and that alone has taught me all these things. I think it's, I have all these other things that I want to do. When do you cut it and let it fly and be its own thing? And I worry perpetually that I've spent too much time on it.
Are you doing anything right now to absolve that fear with deadlines or anything like that?
Yeah, deadlines. And it's funny that there's the old adage of, I forget the exact words as I have this whole session, but any project takes 90%, like 90% of a project. What is it? No, it's the last 10% takes as much time as the first 90%. Boom, that's it.
Boom.
That is
so true.
When you think you are so done, you still have so much work to go.
Yeah.
And I'm in that last 10% realm, but it feels like I'm starting all over again in a lot of ways because it still feels like I can't see the top of the mountain I'm climbing. But I think deadlines help. I work really well under pressure. That's where I thrive. I think a lot of people thrive. But I also think I'm dangling other projects and carrots in front of my face and telling myself I can't touch that until I finish this. And for me, that's way more motivating because I am so eager and excited to do the next thing that I know, based off everything I know about myself now, will take a quarter of the time and will be at a different kind of scale.
Have you ever heard of the line, books are never finished, merely abandoned?
Oh, who said that?
I think the great and powerful Chris Ryan said that.
I love that.
I don't know if it came from him, but I think that when it comes to creative process, that creative projects, more often than not, you aren't kissing this beautiful thing and releasing it into the world. You're kicking it into a field and shooting it with a shotgun and saying, I need to be done with you.
Yeah. It's like you're birthing the ugliest baby and you're going, Evolution, do your work.
Yeah.
Please get better.
Yeah.
Just do your own thing over there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it is, seriously, it's cool to see, you go through so many iterations of learning through a single project. And I think that anyone can get these kinds of lessons, not by listening to other people talk about it, but just by doing it themselves. Like, it really, failing fast and failing forward is, it's the way that you get good at shit, it seems. And it's a very painful process to move through. But as you say, a healthy dose of despair is important for any creative project.
That is true. Staring at the void.
All right. Well, as soon as it's out, we're going to blow this shit up on this podcast. We really turned this around. We were bombing, but I think that you offered some great insights, as you always do. We went from breath work to voice to business and beyond, and it was just great catching up with you, man. We'll talk about New York next time.
I love that.
Always a pleasure having you here on the mic. And if people want to reach out to you, if Chris Lint wants to send you an email, where can people reach out?
Well, they can just reach out to charlie@signandsapien.com. Or they can just go to my Instagram, calling Mr. Hart.
Love it. So great chatting, my friend. Let's get this project out into the world.
I love it. Great to be here.
Bye.
Bye.
That's our show. Before you head off into your day, you can go to tierman.substack.com to get my newsletter, my articles, thoughts, ramblings. If you want to hear more from me, tierman.substack.com is the place to be. That's it for now. Thank you so much for tuning in. Get out in the water, whatever body of water is closest to you, lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.